Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a lot to talk about. We thought we were going to have an off week this week for Easter and some other things going on, but you know, the disaster world never lets us rest when we want to rest, and we know what that's like in the response community, folks, don't we? So without much further ado, let's bring in my co-host, Sam Bradley, and we'll jump into this episode. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie. Yeah, I hear you're getting some wetness out there on the East Coast quite a bit.
Yeah, and the weather's affecting, you know, the response to the recent events here in the Baltimore area. And, you know, it's affecting, you know, the response and recovery efforts and things. And we'll talk about that here more in a bit.
Yep. Well, we got Miss Becky with us. She's not into the meteorology like she used to be, but maybe she can help us out with some of this. Hi, Bex.
Hello. I'll do my best Dan stand-in.
Yeah. Yeah, our AccuWeather meteorologist is out playing games or something. I don't know.
He's in the band. He's playing in the band. Yeah.
What does he play, Beck?
He plays the alto saxophone. He was really? In the blue band. Yeah, he was in the blue band marching band when he went to Penn State.
Very nice.
Yeah, he's pretty good. He doesn't like to advertise that. It's very modest.
I somehow, you know, we've got all these guitar players and bass players, but I just can't picture that.
Hey, yeah. Let's find a picture and embarrass him or something.
Well, I think we are. If he listens to this, well, rock on there, Dan. Something he has, you know, you need something like that when you work a lot, because that way you can kind of just enjoy yourself for a while.
Yes.
But we're going to talk about, you know, we talked a little bit, I don't know, a couple months ago about what this season may look like in terms of hurricanes. But I got a little, little tickler from AccuWeather this morning, and I started reading that, and it's like, whoa. So I thought I'd pass that on to you guys. It's looking like it's going to be a supercharged hurricane season that can spawn a near record number of storms in the Atlantic, to the extent that they may run out of names like they did a few years ago. So that, as we know, that starts on June 1st and runs through the end of November when it wants to. But we never quite know when that's going to end or start, because it's been known to start early, too. So there's a kind of a frenzy of tropical systems. And like I said, they think one may spin up even before the calendar flips to June. And the comment they made was the 2024 Atlantic hurricane season is forecast to feature well above the historic average number of tropical storms, hurricanes, major hurricanes, and direct U.S. impacts. So we looked at last year, there were 19 named storms. I guess a lot of this has to do with the warm water and the fact that, let me get this right, it's going to El Nino this year, and it was the other one last year. Can you help me out here, Becky?
Sorry, mute button. La Nina is the other one.
Yeah. Well, I guess that changes a lot because the sea surface temperatures are well above historical averages where we tend to have hurricanes come in. And what they do, I guess, and you would know this, Becky, the forecast, the long-range forecast, has a lot to do with previous years that had kind of the same types of issues, El Nino, whatever, and, you know, temperatures in the ocean, and I don't know what all the factors are. You probably know better than I do. But it says something about La Nina resulting in less disruptive winds, like wind shear. But the faster we transition to La Nina, the more active the hurricane season is likely to be. So what they're looking at is 20 to 25 named storms across the Atlantic Basin, including 8 to 12 hurricanes, 4 to 7 major hurricanes, and 4 to 6 direct U.S. impacts. And that's pretty major. They had a little graphic here showing that where the average is somewhere around 14. Well, we're looking at 20 to 25. What do you know, Becky, about ACE, accumulated cyclone energy? Maybe that's a damn thing.
I mean, I can give it kind of a simple overview. Basically, it's the amount of energy that a storm produces. So a larger, powerful storm is going to produce a lot of ACE. A small storm, it will produce a lower amount of ACE. And so if they're forecasting a lot of ACE throughout a season, it means that there's been significant storms. And whether or not they make landfall doesn't have any bearing on that. It's just sort of the energy that they produce.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, you go ahead.
No, I was going to say this chart shows the 30-year historical average as being 123 for ACE, but this year it's looking at 175 to 225. Oof, and where direct impacts are usually around 4, we're looking at 4 to 6. So it could be really nasty. It's saying there's a 10 to 15% chance of 30 or more named storms this year. So I guess that ACE is a big factor in what the forecasters look at. And of course, what usually happens is the Texas coast, Florida Panhandle, South Florida, and Carolinas are at higher than average risk. So be diligent out there, people. What do you think, Jamie?
Well, I mean, I've been thinking about, it's been a long while since we've had a storm come up and track up far enough up the East Coast to hit the Mid-Atlantic region with any relative strength. But we're due is the way I've been looking at it the last few hurricane seasons, that, something's going to come up and come in the Chesapeake Bay region and strike Maryland, D.C., Philadelphia area. With significant storm impacts. Regardless, as we saw last year and in the year before that, even that, sometimes the storms maintain a lot of their strength even as they get farther inland. So something that comes in along the Gulf Coast can still pack quite a punch by the time it exits the Northeast, back into the Atlantic Ocean, that it can still have significant moisture and wind velocity associated with the storm, even though it's post-tropical. And, Becky, I mean, you've seen some of those impacts there in central Pennsylvania too.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of storms that are a good example of just because a storm has made landfall and, potentially lost, hurricane-force winds doesn't mean it can't still have a very, very significant impact. Irene back in 2011 caused devastating flooding up in New York, Catskills region. I mean, just horrific flooding. And then obviously last year, 2 years ago, there was Hurricane Ida that made landfall in the Gulf Coast and then went on to have severe impacts in the Northeast, New Jersey, New York, Southern New England region, where there were tornadoes and really, really awful flooding. So it just you always got to be paying attention, have an understanding of where the storm is going, even after it makes landfall. And I think one of the biggest things to really take away is that the main hazard in a hurricane or tropical system that causes the most deaths is actually the water. It's not the wind, which is what gets, all the crazy videos. You see the debris flying around. It's the storm surge. It's the inland flooding from all the heavy rainfall. That is what causes the most death, the most fatalities from a hurricane.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I was thinking, was it last year or the year before that it actually, nobody really expected, and I think this is a more recent event where, like you were saying, it isn't just hitting the Gulf Coast. These storms are going way up inland, both on the East Coast and just going north of where they hit. Is that true? I mean, is this kind of a newer thing that they go?
No, not necessarily. It really just depends on the track, and the track is very much dependent on the current steering and what may force a storm to take a certain track. So, is there an area of low pressure that is coming across the United States and forces a storm to potentially curve a certain direction. Like with Hurricane Sandy, that storm sort of merged with a really strong area of low pressure, which ultimately caused that sort of westward left hook to bring Sandy into New Jersey. And if you recall with Sandy, there was a significant snow event in parts of the like Southern Appalachians and like Shenandoah area. So you can get these, you know, merging storm systems, even with hurricanes. And that is what impacts the direction a storm goes more than anything, is some of these more, you call them synoptic scale features, but
yeah, I was driving,
overall weather patterns.
I was driving through some of that snow on my way to EMS World Expo in New Orleans. We actually left a day early to try to get past the storm because we saw it coming and in back in towards the coast and it's going to impact our driving route. And we still got caught in some of the snow crossing over into like the Tennessee area and down into the mountains there. So yeah, it's amazing to see how big some of these storms can get. And if they are packing a little bit more energy because the surface water temperatures are higher, that can cause them to carry a lot more of that force. Correct, Becky?
Yeah, I mean, the warm water is essentially what fuels a tropical system. So the warmer the water, the more fuel they have to strengthen and gather and carry more moisture. So the warm sea surface temperatures are probably one of the most concerning components of this forecast. And the fact that they're so warm so early, like we're barely at the end of March, and we're, if I'm understanding this correctly, we're seeing close to June level sea surface temperatures. And I think that's why some forecasters are getting concerned that we may see an early start to the season. Also why it's important to remember that weather does not care at all what the calendar month is. You can have tornadoes at any time of the year, and you can have hurricanes well outside of the quote unquote season from June to November.
Oh, very true. And I had to go work on after Hurricane Sandy, right when they were putting out everything that got destroyed in their home, which was basically everything. So the streets were filled with just stuff that they had to figure out where to put it, I guess. What do you do with all that trash? Because that's what it is at that point. Well, and like Jamie mentioned earlier, speaking of Maryland, you had to have lived in a cave the last few days not to hear heard about the bridge incident. And where exactly? Well, Baltimore Harbor obviously is in Baltimore, but I don't know if it's, how far is it from you, Jamie?
It's about 45 minutes away. You know, we drive right. It's an alternate route to I-95 south or north through the city of Baltimore. The actual I-95 corridor runs through tunnels that go underneath Baltimore Harbor, but you can't take certain payloads and certain hazardous materials through the tunnels. So all of that trucking traffic goes around, and the shortest route to go around Baltimore is across the Key Bridge, Francis Scott Key Bridge, which, of course, as if you've seen the video, the bulk of it is no longer there. It's a 1.6-mile long bridge that spans the Patapsco River, and that is where the harbor, the main section of the harbor, exits into the Chesapeake Bay. That area is completely blocked off now, with the main span of the bridge in the water and blocking any cargo ships that were currently in harbor from getting out. There is Carnival Cruise Line has a cruise that departs from Baltimore down into the Caribbean. And there's a ship currently out that can no longer come back to dock in Baltimore. So everybody is getting let off in Norfolk, Virginia, and having to find transportation back up to their cars in Baltimore. It's you know, that's just an example of the widespread impact this is going to have. There are 12 major ships, container ships in the harbor that will not be able to get out for the foreseeable future. And it's going to take weeks before they can get the main channel cleared, because there are only certain number of shipping cranes that are in existence on the East Coast, and they have to be brought in to Baltimore because none of them are in Baltimore. So
strangely, yeah,
it's going to take time just to get the equipment they need to start cleaning up the mess, let alone clean up the mess. And this all happened because a container ship lost power and impacted one of the main pylons supporting the bridge and caused its complete collapse. And if you haven't seen the video, look it up. It's out there. It was all caught on a live stream transportation video that happened about 1:30 a.m. a few days ago. And luckily, and this is the miracle of it, because usually, I mean, this bridge carries about 30,000 people, vehicle traffic every day. Even late at night, there's traffic on the bridge. There was road construction going on one of the spans. And so there were police officers at both sides of the bridge to make sure people were obeying the traffic cones. And the ship called with 3 minutes notice to say they were going to hit the bridge, and the police were able to stop traffic. So the only people that were on the bridge were the construction crew. And unfortunately, 6 members of that crew lost their lives in the collapse. They've recovered 2 of the bodies. I think 4 are still yet to be found. We're very lucky that it wasn't worse than it was. If this had happened at 8 a.m. on a typical work day, there would have been rush hour traffic going across that bridge, and there would have been no way to get them off of it fast enough to stop a major incident with much more loss of life and injury.
Yeah, I can't even, that keeps going through my head. I can't even conceive of that worst case scenario. It's just too bad they couldn't have gotten that word out sooner. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know where these guys were on the bridge or anything else, but if a big ship is coming toward the bridge at a place it's not supposed to be,
Well, if you look at the video, I mean, if you watch the video, there's the channel's not very wide that the ship has to sail through to go between the two major supports of the bridge under the largest span. So it wouldn't necessarily have even noticed that the bridge, the boat was off course until the last possible instant. It apparently lost power, and then the current pushed it very quickly off course, and it was unable to regain power. They apparently dropped their anchor to try to stop the forward progress. They instituted several emergency measures to try to steer the boat, but were unable to make it steer. And this boat is big, more than 3 football fields long, to give you an idea of how large it is. So, that's just an enormous piece of equipment carrying thousands of containers bound for Sri Lanka, was where they were on their way out to.
Yeah. You don't move anything that big where it doesn't want to go. And I don't know that dropping the anchor was probably real helpful, although that's part of their protocol.
Well, how do you stop something that big, even if it's only going 8 miles an hour? How do you stop something with that much forward inertia and momentum you don't stop anything like that. It's like saying you're going to stop a train in time to avoid a collision on a crossing. You can't stop the train. Even a slow moving train can't stop that quickly. So it's just unfortunate. It was a perfect storm of events. The only thing that makes it, like I said, any better than it could have been, it could have been a lot worse had it happened at a different time of day. And so we can be thankful that only 6 people lost their lives. It could have been far worse.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's a deep channel port, like 40 or 50 feet with a lot of strong current. So, and the water's very cold. So you had to know once those people were in there for any period of time, they were going to succumb to hypothermia. And if Joe was here, we'd make him talk about that a little bit. I think we could probably.
Well, I mean, you know, I did some looking up just to have some information on it. You know, the water temperature was around 48 degrees Fahrenheit. The survivability is 1 to 3 hours in that temperature range, depending on some other factors. They were able to rescue two people from the water, one with no injuries, and they refused treatment on the scene. Another person who's still in the trauma center. So everyone else was apparently in a vehicle and was trapped immediately as soon as the bridge went down. So,
yeah, because they're still trying to speculate if a lot of the vehicles that went in weren't those of the construction workers.
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation. And the visibility is less than a foot in the water, even during daylight hours. And so they're using side-scanning sonar to visualize what's under the surface and where the debris is. But it's a very slow, painstaking process. They're calling it off after dark. Today, rain and heavier winds moved in that caused even worse surface and undersurface conditions for the divers. But, you know, they're basically, as I heard one dive expert on the news say, they're searching by braille, essentially. You can't see, you know, if you put your arm out at full length in front of you underwater, you can't see your hand. So that means you could swim into an obstruction. You could swim into it and knock something over that causes something else bigger to collapse. They're being very painstaking and only searching on the periphery of it because they just don't want to lose a diver.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is something else Joe could talk about if he was here, because that's what they do. But you know, the other thing that I haven't seen in anything I've read is there might have been considerable trauma to these guys as the bridge is coming apart and they're falling some distance into the water. So that might have been another factor.
Yeah, depending on where they were on the span, it could have been as much as 170 feet into the water. The bridge would have collapsed down. And then, of course, the top of the bridge comes down on top of that. So it would have been, you know, significant trauma. If they weren't just trapped, it could have been crushing forces and everything else that happened. You know, that's a lot of speculation. We don't know. It'll be a long time before we know, because I suspect that they aren't going to recover all the bodies anytime soon, that they're going to have to start recovering and pulling out pieces of the bridge superstructure before they can get all those vehicles out of there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's really unfortunate for those guys. But like you said, it could have been much, much worse. People, you know, when you look at that video, the bridge just kind of crumbles. And you go, well, it looks like a tinker toy. But it's a 47-year-old bridge, but it was apparently up to code. And it was just did you hit it just right, I guess?
Yeah, well, there's so much that, so much of those bridges depend on the next section over to maintain the structural support, right? And if one section of the bridge fails catastrophically, it causes that domino effect, which you can see in the video. The other thing is the bridge was built in the 70s. Bridge codes changed in the 80s and again in the 90s. So it was up to code for when it was built, and it was considered safe and was frequently inspected. But again, it did not have all of the redundancies. However, several engineers said even the redundancies in the later code would probably have not protected it from at least a significant collapse of sections of the bridge.
Well, the good news is, like you said, it wasn't at the worst time of day for that. The cops were there and were able to stop other people going out to the bridge, even with 3 minutes notice. And the fact that they put out that May Day, all those things together, probably did it save some lives. But where are we at now? Well, about 4,900 trucks cross that bridge every day. So that's going to affect shipping. And like you were saying, Jamie, you know, shipping in and out of there is obviously going to be an issue, not to mention, you know, the cruise lines and so forth and so on.
Well, and yeah, and so they'll divert to Norfolk, Virginia, which is the next port to the south. They'll divert to Philadelphia and New Jersey and New York ports north of Baltimore for the time being. It'll take weeks to clear the channel again before they can start using the shipping in the harbor again. That's just my estimate based on everything I've heard. If it takes up to 2 weeks to get the equipment in, and then you can't even begin removing anything before then, and it's going to be a highly specialized deconstruction effort, you know, salvage effort. Don't expect anything to change anytime soon. So there's going to be increased traffic around the western portion of the Baltimore Beltway as it picks up the traffic load that would have gone across around to the east. And, we'll deal with more traffic. It's just going to be the fact of life. It took 5 years to build that bridge originally.
Whoa, really?
And so imagine it'll take several years at least to get a new bridge in place.
Oh my God, I had no idea it took that long. Even though the feds have agreed to do everything they can to try and expedite that and to pay for it, like you said, the time it takes. You know, when you look at all the construction of the bridge, that's a lot of metal work.
It's a lot of metal work. It's a lot of specialized building capabilities, and it has to be done in a certain order at a certain time frame. The weather has to be right. I imagine there's things that you can only do when there's little or no wind, when you're laying suspension sections in and things like that. So it's going to take a couple of years before that bridge is replaced, at least, if not longer.
Yeah. I wonder if they can build on to the part that wasn't damaged or whether they have to start over again.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. And I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that at this point. And it'll depend on what damage was sustained to those other sections next to the bridge. I'd just like to come back to the response side of things. You know, people were on scene very quickly. It was a textbook coordinated response between state, local, and federal officials. There were state police helicopters, Baltimore City helicopter, and a Coast Guard helicopter, as well as Coast Guard boats, state and local boating assets in and around the area within 15, 20 minutes of the collapse. So there was an instant response and a well-coordinated response from everything I've seen. There's nothing to indicate that anything there went wrong, other than the fact that there was little they could do once they got on scene. The two people that were able to be rescued were rescued relatively quickly and pulled from the water, and there was no one else to find at that point.
Yeah, I guess you can say that something good comes out of things that are bad. So, like I said, this is not a worst case scenario. What are you thinking, Becky?
Sorry, it's like they kind of like pushed I'm on my phone, and that's not as efficient as the computer for the mute button. I think Jamie and you have really talked about this in a really succinct way. I think the ripple effect from like an economical standpoint is going to be felt for a very, very long time, and we don't, you know, it's hard to grasp fully the impact that a port like that has on our economy. And I don't know this in any detail, but obviously if ships can't get in and out, if trucks have to take a different route, I think one of the more fascinating things is now where are all the trucks carrying hazardous materials going to go? They're going to have to take a lot longer route, and that's interesting.
It'll add 45 minutes to an hour to their trip around the city.
Because
they have to go around the western side of the city rather than pretty much straight line. They just kind of veer off 95, go across the bridge, join 95 again, and head on north or south. So it's a little bit more of a loop around to the western side.
Oh, yeah. Well, make the best of it. It blows me away that even though it's logical, it would take that long to rebuild it. I guess that's the way it is.
So I'm so sorry.
To you, Jamie. Thanks for all your good information on this. I figured you'd have it since you're right there.
No, and I appreciate Becky coming on, too. Becky, any final thoughts on hurricane season or on the preparations and preparedness aspect of you know, what we've talked about with the hurricanes or the bridge collapse?
Well, with the bridge collapse, just one quick comment. I saw videos of a few people going around the barricades to apparently try and cross the bridge that was no longer there. So just a reminder to maybe trust that law enforcement has your best interest in mind if the road is closed off. And then, you know, as far as is hurricane season, I don't count on it, you know, not starting until June. Obviously now is the exact right time to be prepared to take a look at your hurricane kit, make sure everything is refreshed, you know, toss out any items that have expired, refresh the water that you have, make sure all your paperwork is up to date and you have photocopies of it. I think you guys, you know, the listeners to this podcast know the drill. Just that now is the time to make sure you're ready to go.
Definitely. Maybe that's something to refresh people's minds on the next few months.
We can do that. We'll have maybe a hurricane kit episode where we can go through it all again. I know we do this every year, but I think it bears talking about. And it's something that we should always keep in mind. Just because we're first responders doesn't mean we don't have people at home that need to be prepared too, whether it's our family or our parents or other relatives and friends. It behooves us to keep them prepared as well. So, Becky, where can folks find you if they want to track down what you're talking about at any given time?
Yeah, I'm talking about some alert and warning stuff over on LinkedIn, Becky DePodwin. And then I guess most of the time I would say I post over on Blue Sky at WXBex and the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, which has been quiet lately. And I think we should get it going again.
I think that's a great idea. And Sam, how about you?
Yes, in all those places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley at Robin. And I'm as much as I can visit the wonderful community we have on Facebook, which should be more often for all of us, and on disasterpodcast.com. How about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations out there. So look me up. And of course, at disasterpodcast.com. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank Dr. Joe Holly and the folks over at Paragon Medical Education Group for their continued support and sponsorship of the show. I urge you to check them out for super awesome customized training evolutions for your services. You really can't go wrong with just making a phone call and talking with them about what they can do that is based upon your budget and what your specific needs are. So check them out at paragonmedicalgroup.com, or you can contact them through disasterpodcast.com. And our Facebook group as well. We always appreciate all their help. Good episode, Sam. And we, you know, like I said at the beginning, that we try to take a break and the weather and disaster news catches up with us anyway.
Well, you have tomorrow. I hope. I hope there's not another disaster. But if there is one, like Becky said, we need to be prepared. So From one year to the next, you might even forget where your kit went. So think about that, and we'll be talking more about it later.